Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Center for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Ava.
And I'm Beth. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience to psychology whilst occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
This week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Ariana Brown, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Today, we spoke about collective action and support for policies that address inequalities. Specifically, we talk about what types of information spark more support for addressing inequality than others. And we also talk about the different types of actions that people might take to address those inequalities. I will warn you that Beth said she found this episode a little bit depressing, but I personally actually found it very inspiring. And hopefully, if you do at any points feel a little bit hopeless or depressed from this episode, that by the end of it, you actually feel like you have some actionable items to think about and some ways that you might be able to effectively contribute to any collective action problem or social problem that you care about.
I'm Ariana Brown. I am a postdoc at the University of Pennsylvania in the Annenberg Public Policy Center and the Department of Psychology. So I got my PhD at NYU in social psychology. And broadly, I study how people communicate and discuss information about social disparities and inequality. And in general, just thinking about how do we address larger social issues, whether that's racial injustice or climate change, things like that.
So one of your most recent studies looks at the kinds of information that people might hear about when we're thinking about disparities and how learning about those different types of disparities, so specifically health disparities, belonging disparities, or economic disparities, led to different levels of support for social change and for policies that support social change. And you also had this key variable of moral sanctity and moral values that seems to underlie these differences. So could you tell us a little bit about how you started that study and what you found?
So me and my colleagues were thinking a little bit about what starts social movements, what sort of events start social movements. And we were thinking about, you know, back in 2016, when Donald Trump became president, and like when there was the most outrage was when he have made that comment about, you know, grabbing women by the pussy, right? It was like that big phrase that really got people galvanized. Of course, there's many things that galvanized people, but that was one example. And then we were thinking about how Black Lives Matter started. It was ignited, and it was often after the murder of a Black American. And so we were thinking about these larger social movements, and how they were often started when someone was violated or their bodily health was violated. And so we were thinking about what sorts of examples of things really start to galvanize people and get people, you know, standing up in the streets, wanting to create more equity, create more justice, create more fairness. And it seemed to not always, but circle around this idea of health. And unfortunately, particularly in the US, there are tons of racial disparities and disparities in other domains as well, in these different categories, right? So thinking about disparities in health, there's disparities in medical diagnoses, there's disparities in access to hospitals and pharmacies. And then there's also, of course, economic disparities. So disparities particularly between Black and white Americans in wealth, in income levels, in management positions, the list goes on and on. And so we're thinking about how might we discuss these different examples and see what might galvanize people the most, both in terms of would they want to engage in social change by, for example, going to protests, volunteering, things like that, and also support policies that would seek to address some of these disparities. And so, of course, as social psychologists, we're like, we could test this, we can create some experiments. And so that's what we did. And we wanted to, of course, look at what are the mechanisms, why do we see differences, if we do see differences between wanting to address these different types of disparities. And one possibility was drawn from really classic social psychology of fundamental values. And right, there's Maslow's classic hierarchy of needs, with physiological needs being the most core, and then followed by other needs, including things like economics and belonging. But there's like right that hierarchy. And so perhaps we think about that hierarchy a little bit when we're confronted with these different types of disparities in these different hierarchical domains, which is also connected to this idea of what kind of issues do people find really fundamental, right? What are things that we really should protect? And there's work on moral sacred values that often find that of healthcare and bodily harm are things that we shouldn't trade off. So we shouldn't be able to pay someone to hurt someone else. Like, that's something really fundamental that we really care about. It's really core value is to like protect somebody's health. So perhaps people would want to address or take action to address health disparities more than disparities in other domains if they're considering health as something really core to their values and something they want to protect. So in the first studies, we focused on support for engaging in collective action. So things like wanting to go to a protest, posting on social media, donating money to address the issues. So we exposed people to different examples of disparities, a few in health, a few in economics, a few in belonging. And we picked these three domains because these were often the three that were talked about in social sciences as fundamental for your overall health. So feeling your health is taken care of, feeling like your economics are taken care of, and feeling like you belong in a community. So these were the three domains we focused on. And then we asked, after they read about an example of the disparity, would you want to address this disparity? And then with these concrete actions of how likely would you be to want to go to a protest, donate, post on social media, things like that. And in those studies, we found that people reported that they wanted to engage in action to address health disparities more than the economic and belonging disparities. And we even found this in a sample of both half white Americans and half those identify as Black American. So we found that same overarching pattern that people said they want to address health over economic and belonging disparities. And then we wanted to test this pattern in a more ecologically valid way. So we ran a few ads on Facebook where we just gave a short description of what is a health disparity and what is an economic disparity. In these studies, we took out the belonging condition because we also found some effects where people reported wanting to address the economic a little bit more than the belonging disparities. So we were like, let's do a more conservative test. We'll look at just health and econ. And in that experiment, basically, we would put these ads on Facebook, and then Facebook would run this kind of like an independent samples t-test, but they do their own little fancy algorithms, whatever they do behind the curtain, and they tell you what ad was more engaging and what people were more engaged with. And so with doing that, we also found that when you're just giving a little infographic on Facebook, people seem to be more engaged, whether that's kind of clicking or spending a little bit more time on or looking or sharing information that focused on health compared to the information that was focusing on economics. And so that was a little bit more ecologically valid support for our hypothesis. And then we ran a study where we had a nationally representative sample. So that was really nice because, you know, we often use these very convenient samples. So we were like, okay, let's try and see if we can get a nationally representative sample. And then we switched to looking at policy support. So especially because often how we address these types of disparities is with policies. And often these policies are financial in nature, right? So it's, let's put some money into the budget to address this particular issue, or let's allocate some money to try to address these issues. And so the policy in and of itself is economic in nature. So in the nationally representative sample, we asked generally, would you support some policies that would address these disparities? So it wasn't very specific and concrete. And then that study, we find the same pattern, particularly comparing health and economics. So people support wanting to address health disparities via these sorts of general policies compared to if it goes to economic disparities. And then, yeah, we really wanted to see, okay, oftentimes we're not just like this sort of general, yeah, I support this thing, but in practice, would I actually give some of my resources up to address this issue? And perhaps when people are thinking about health issues, it might not affect your wallet as personally as something that might be more economic. Perhaps when we're thinking about economic issues, we're thinking about how I might need to give up some of my money. I might need to reallocate resources, and that might affect me more personally. Versus when focusing on health, perhaps people are just thinking of, okay, like maybe let's provide more access by building hospitals and pharmacies. And they're not thinking about how much it affects their own wallets as much, for example. And so in the last study, we had people either read an economic policy where money, so some of their income tax would be going directly towards addressing either health-based disparities or economic-based disparities. And in that study, we found that same pattern where people reading that the policy would go to reducing health disparities reported more support for that policy than those who read about the policy going towards addressing economic disparities. And so I think that gave us a little bit more confidence that this seems to be really about something regarding health disparities that people really want to try to engage with and address. And we do find this sort of correlational support that it's due to this violation of your moral sacred values. You want to protect health more than you want to protect economics. And that leads to greater support for these sorts of policies.
It's super interesting. And when I was reading through the study, one thing maybe cynically, I felt like the middleman between what is driving the effect of health driving more support for collective action and for these social policies was that maybe people are able to kind of scapegoat the individuals, especially if we're talking about racial inequalities, are able to kind of scapegoat the idea that maybe Black Americans are just not, you know, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps the way that we should in America. So I was kind of wondering what you think about that and how you see that in terms of the model that you have of moral sanctity and whether you think that this is also important or less important.
I completely agree. I think that there's definitely more mediators that we have yet to test, which we are currently testing. And we do find support for this idea that perhaps people are blaming those who are at the, you know, victimizing end of the disparity, right, more for their situation when considering economics and belonging compared to health. So we do find some support for that. So in some of our newer studies, we were focusing on, does this generalize to other inequalities? So we focused on disparities between LGBTQ and non-LGBTQ Americans. And we do find that blame is also a mediator. So people are putting more onus on LGBTQ Americans for the economic strain and for lack of belonging compared to the greater strain of health. So yeah, I think that there's multiple mediators that are at play with this effect, and it's not necessarily just about health being a violation of this morally sacred value, even though we do still find support for that as a mediator, which I think is really important, right? So I'd love to somehow try and turn that off. I feel like, unfortunately, in the US, we get this sort of meritocratic Protestant work ethic is so embedded in our culture that we really do blame people for their economic strife, which is why you see not as much support for a lot of social services and less support for food stamps if people have like stronger meritocratic views. It's just like less like help, like social help, I guess, or economic help. And so I think that sort of perception that people are to blame for their economic situation is really prevalent, and how to turn that off, because there's tons of work, right, in sociology and psychology showing that oftentimes people's situation and economic situation is often a generational issue. It's not because individuals are lazy. It's because of these structural and societal factors that make it impossible to move up the ladder and make it really difficult to get out of these really, really tough economic situations. And we prey on people who are poor or where interest rates are much higher, right? The list goes on. And so trying to turn that blame off is definitely somewhere that I'd be really interested in taking my research and trying to understand, why do we put the onus on people when they're struggling for some situations but not others, right? I think that that's like a really important piece. And then also just, I think people don't want to help others all the time. Like we are I think one of the bigger downsides of being a more individualistic society is this really lack of empathy and the lack of wanting to concretely help or take away something from yourself to give to others, right? This sort of like dismantling privilege, I think, is really, really, really difficult. And I see that in a lot of my other work as well. And so what are ways that we can do that and try and get people more on board with creating more equity is it's a big, big question mark.
Yeah, that's definitely something that we're going to talk about with some of your other work. But before we get there, I was just wondering, with these two mediators, do you think that maybe one way in which they could be operating is that they might be kind of in line with this idea that sometimes conservatives and liberals might have different underlying morals, and so appealing to their different types of morals is a really important way to persuade? Do you think that maybe for people who are already kind of more inclined to see inequity as an issue, that the violation of these moral values might be more important and might kind of push them more in that direction of supporting these policies even more? Whereas for conservatives, it might be like that other push of, oh, well, I'm just going to blame these people. Whereas like, I actually, you know, for if it's like, there are just fewer hospitals in this area, like I can't blame the person who lives there for the fact that there are fewer hospitals. So do you think that could be, and did you see any differences in your samples with political leanings at all?
In these studies, we tested for moderation in political ideology, and we didn't find moderation. Honestly, we would basically found that conservatives more generally were just less supportive of these policies compared to those who identify as more liberal and less supportive of wanting to take action. So oftentimes, if you just look at the conservative sample, essentially they had less opposition to address health disparities than economic and belonging. So less opposition for those policies if they focused on health. So it wasn't necessarily that we found that more support amongst those groups to wanting to address these issues. They just were not really that supportive in general of wanting to address these issues. So, you know, on that scale of 1 to 7, where 1 is strongly opposed, 7 is strongly support, they were under the midpoint. So it was really about decreasing that opposition when talking about health compared to economics and belonging. So in general, it's a tough road of trying to convince people that this is a big problem. And I think my research is just showing little small ways that we might be able to chip away at this sort of opposition that we see to try to address disparities, particularly racial disparities. And yeah, one way to try to chip away at that is to focus on these sorts of violations of one's bodily health, violations of physical safety as examples of these disparities. It doesn't mean that we should not focus on economic and belonging disparities. They're incredibly important as well. But perhaps when trying to galvanize support, giving the examples that focus on health, or even talking about economics, but then talking about a consequence of that is these sorts of health disparities and how this manifests for people's health, is just one potential, I think, implication for how to talk about some of these issues and try and kind of market the way to get people to care.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think it is a useful takeaway, as if you're trying to convince people, maybe this is the way to talk about it, especially if they're people that you just want to reduce the opposition in. Right. So I think that is really helpful. And it's nice to have a study where there's kind of a strong takeaway. One question that I had was that, so in this study, basically what I read from it was the idea that these issues of moral sanctity are really important, and they're really something that we should focus on when we're thinking about how to galvanize support. And this is really in line with some of these models of collective action that already exist, like the SIMCA model, like the social identity model, mm-hmm. where moral conviction is a really important aspect of galvanizing support. But on the other hand, as we kind of touched on, morality feels like it's getting increasingly polarized, and moralizing issues also makes them feel like you can't touch them, like you can't really talk to someone about them because they're their mm-hmm. moral convictions, and for the same reasons that they push people to act and they're unbreakable things that make people feel like they have to do something, it also means that it's really hard to have conversations about those things. So you, do you see healthcare as kind of being, given that it's in that Maslow's hierarchy, at the very bottom of the hierarchy, that these issues with physical safety and health are just kind of something that everyone can get on board with, that they're a moral value that almost everyone kind of shares, that kind of goes across these lines? Or is it something that you think could also sort of become contentious?
I wish I could answer in the more optimistic way and be like, woohoo, we found the catch-all, everyone's going to agree. But there's other work finding that if you talk about COVID disparities and mention that there's a racial disparity, just emphasizing that there's a racial issue, people become less supportive of measures that we're trying to address COVID. And so, yeah, I wish I could say that just talking about health will bridge the gap across different kinds of moralizing issues, but I don't think so. I think there's almost like mental gymnastics in how to discuss these hot topic issues that have become political, even though why would a racial disparity be political? I wish it wasn't. But utilizing that sort of, how do I change my speech to get somebody who's normally very anti this issue more pro? One way to do that might be, you know, to try and emphasize, like thinking about Flint, Michigan, for example, like when that got a lot of attention, when people were recognizing that there was lead in the water and it was affecting people's health, right? And so this isn't about people purposefully putting lead in the water, right? Who would do that ever? And so it's an issue that's affecting a particular community more than others, and it's affecting, in the US, Black American communities more than other communities. And so talking about those examples that could very easily happen wherever someone lives, that there could be lead in the water due to some cost-saving policy that was created in that nation. And so perhaps it allows people to see, like, okay, it's really important to live, right? It's really important to, like, get what you need, get those basic things like water and food and resources. And we are, as a nation, are not allowing some people to get those basic needs. And so what can we do about that? And so I think that trying to frame it in ways that allow people to perspective take a little bit more, again, I'm totally speculating on data on this, but like, I think it allows people to perspective take more when it has to do with these sorts of bodily issues? Like, how would you feel if your politician decided that they're just going to get the water from a different river and that river had a ton of contaminants and we just had to deal with that and we didn't have measures on how to take those contaminants away? Like, this, it could very easily happen. And I think same thing with other economic situations. I think if we discuss like how easily it is that you can fall into that particular situation, you know, one giant medical bill could very easily put a lot of people in poverty, unfortunately. And so what are the examples that are going to get the least pushback, even though there's probably going to be pushback, unfortunately, for a lot of these issues?
When I listened to this episode, I found it a bit depressing. And so obviously I've lived in America and Australia, so I've experienced both cultures and these kinds of things. And I was thinking, like, oh God, this doesn't have a lot of hope. It seems like people are not really willing to help one another, really. And it made me feel a bit sad, as it should. But then I was thinking about if we did this kind of experiment in Australia. And in Australia, obviously, we have the same issues with racism. Like, that's definitely the same. But when I was thinking about economic worries, I would think that if we were asked, and, you know, Australians might listen to this and completely disagree with me, but I think we would be more willing to help out with issues by paying higher tax. Oh, I'm saying this and I'm thinking maybe people won't agree, but or give more money because mm-hmm. quality of life here is better. So you don't have to have as much money to live an okay life. Even when I was there for undergrad, I loved it and it was amazing, but life was a struggle and money was a much more important thing because you had to have money to go to the doctor or do things. Like, when I was in America, I never went anywhere because I couldn't afford to go on trips. And like, now I'm back in Australia and I'm a PhD student. So I think we earn below minimum wage. Like, we don't earn much, but I can still afford to go places and do things because basic needs are met more. So I was looking at how much I earn in Australian dollars. I've got two scholarships and that's $44,000 a year.
Okay, lay it out on the line, Beth. I love it. Let's go.
Not say that?
No, I think you should.
And then I was looking in American dollars. So that's like 28,000 American dollars a year. And on that, I can't buy heaps of new clothes or I don't know, whatever. But my life is nice. I live in a house that I like that is, you know, I like my room, I like my house, I like my garden. I can go to uni, I can afford food. So even on this very low wage, and I have an extra scholarship, so other PhD students have less, so I don't want to speak for all of them, I can be safe and have a good life. So if someone was to ask me, oh, well, are you willing to give up some of that money to help people for health reasons? I would be like, yeah, I can, because I feel okay. But I was wondering, in America, because it's so much harder to live a good life on less money, it's harder for people to give that up, even when they have a lot of money. Maybe it's like there's more of that fear. Anyway, that was one of my thoughts. I don't know if you have opinions from being from Canada or if this just sounds crazy and I shouldn't have told everyone how much I earn a year.
No, I think financial openness is very important and helpful. I think it's something that people don't talk about enough. I mean, for UCSB, all the UCs, I think our salaries are public domain. And, you know, there was a huge strike in 2022 where all the UCs went on strike. So money's definitely an issue. I will say that, so Beth, like, your experience is also, I feel like, New York and California, which are like the two most expensive like places in the US, possibly the world. And I think there are places in the US where $27,000 would actually stretch like decently far.
Right.
But I think you raise an interesting question of like, when I was asking Ariana about these other mediators. And so like a mediator is basically just a stats term for like the middleman that's doing the work between, let's say, reading about an inequity and then the support that you have for engaging in a collective action or for policy, what's actually like doing the lifting there. And I think here you're basically like kind of suggesting that one of the things that could be influencing that relationship is how much money you have and how much you feel that you would be willing to give up. And maybe also like a cultural variable of whether you feel that you're kind of in like a zero sum situation where if someone gets something, then that means that you can't have it for yourself and you're being deprived. I think that's an interesting point, but I think that maybe still the path that Ariana looked at in this study of like the moral violation of like health and just being like, oh, my physical safety is more of something that I feel like is important to protect, or someone else's physical safety is more important to protect than their access to certain types of economic safety, I guess. I feel like that might still be there, but maybe to a lower extent if you're in a culture where people just feel safer in general with their money.
Yeah, because I thought, okay, well, this is all really depressing. But I thought, well, maybe it is good to think about, well, how does this play out in other countries where things are different? And I was thinking, well, what is my experience in Australia? And I guess then that maybe it goes back to changing these systemic issues within government and welfare, and that it ultimately falls back on that. But I thought it was a good exercise to think, okay, if you're making these decisions in this experiment, what position could you be in where you could feel more like, okay, I just, yeah, I guess the money then, if you feel safer and you have access to the things that you need to live a nice life, I feel like the money ends up not being as big as an issue.
Okay, I actually have two thoughts. First thought is that now that I'm thinking about it, I actually think maybe in a place like the US, you would think that the economic stuff, people would think it's worse because of the fact that if you don't have access to certain things economically, like I remember some German guy that I went to undergrad with, he was like, if you're poor in Europe, you're poor, but if you're poor in the US, you're dead, which is insane, but kind of true. That it's just like so much more dangerous to be poor, that there's no social safety net, which means that economics are so much more actually tied to your physical safety. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have economic opportunities, you also lose physical safety. So you'd think that maybe actually those things would be more tied. So people would be more likely to think an economic violation is bad because it's more similar to a physical violation. Whereas if you're in Australia, you're like, oh, if you don't really have money, then like you're still fine. Like, you know, the government will still pay for your healthcare, will pay for this and that. So maybe if you're in a country like that, and if you see those two things as linked, like if you have the awareness that they're linked, maybe you would see those as closer together. But I think that another thing, which I guess is like competing with what I just said, is the fact that in the US, I think there's a lot of bootstrap mentality, which I don't know if you have that in Australia, where it's just like, oh, if you're poor, like it's your fault. Like that question of blame that we were talking about at the end with Ariana, that feeling, even though in the US, your physical safety is so tied to your economic situation, that somehow your economic situation is still your fault. It's not about the system. It's not about something accidental that happened to you. It's your responsibility as an individual. And maybe that is doing a lot of heavy lifting too, as we kind of discussed with Ariana. But do you feel like those are cultural narratives that exist in Australia as well?
It's not to the same extent. So we don't have the same bootstrap. Like, to some degree we do, but not to the same extent as America. But then it's interesting because I feel like those bootstrap individualistic things in America can also be the reasons for some of the great things about America too. So I always found that it was really celebrated if you were achieving well, and I don't know, and everyone can be a superstar there, I guess, because it is more of an individualistic culture. So you can all be PhD superstars and academics and everyone, and that's celebrated. Whereas in Australia, we have this thing called tall poppy syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
Have we spoken about this before?
No, but a Dutch person told me about this, about going to Australia, and there was tall poppy syndrome. Yeah.
Tall poppy syndrome, it's this idea that successful people are kind of criticized and you don't really want to be the tallest poppy, which is so different to America. So I don't know. There's just, I mean, it's all very complicated why all these things come about. I think those things also play into why we have less of a bootstrapping culture as well. So if it's not really celebrated to be a superstar here. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Do you think that's bad though? Because you phrase this as there are some great things about America. Like, you can be a superstar and, like, you're celebrated for success. Do you think that's a good thing? I'm not convinced that's a good thing.
No, I don't know either. I guess then maybe if it's good to stand out and go against the grain, you can come up with more innovative ideas. It sounds like I'm like, woo-hoo, to these kind of beliefs. And I don't really know if I am.
Well, it sounds like two extremes. Like,
yeah,
one is like you're rewarded for becoming the best and like crushing everyone in your path. And then the other one is like, don't even stand out a little bit. I'm kind of surprised because the tall poppy thing, is it similar to the Dutch saying of do normal, which we heard Dutch people say a lot, which is just like chill, like don't be crazy. I'm sure a Dutch person would be like, that's not what it means. But it's like, I mean, I heard it as like be normal, like do normal.
No, so you can be very, I don't know, alternative, do your own thing, have your own style, be who you are, be creative, any of that stuff. But when it comes to like striving for success, I guess, in terms of a traditional sense of like money or academic achievement or all that kind of stuff, then it's like, no, just you can do that, but we're not going to be like, yes, you're the best person ever. That's not what we're going to think.
I don't think it's great to say, yes, you're the best person ever to people who are doing things. That's my personal take. I feel like that's the seed of like the growth mindsets versus fixed mindsets of like telling kids like you're amazing and you're the best versus like you're doing good things, like you're putting in good work, like rewarding people for the static achievement instead of like, I don't know.
No, I agree. I guess it's like people then maybe will join less clubs. I don't know what I'm saying. All right, I'm just gonna stop.
Well, I feel like what we're concluding is that, and Beth, this is what it's like to be a social psychologist, honestly, is you're like, it could be that. I don't know. And then you're like a little dog with a leash, you know, like suddenly you're wrapped around
it's
your
horrible.
Own leash.
Because you're like, What even is any of this?
No, that's... What the... Yeah, that's literally me
like
every time I'm thinking about a study. But what I'm hearing is that I feel like we had a lot of research ideas and like we need more data. It'd be cool to look at this in a different culture. It'd be cool to look at cultural moderations. And I do feel like maybe the variable of moral sanctity is probably something that people would agree on. It feels like it's something that, like, you know, Maslow's hierarchy, which I was like, wow, Maslow's hierarchy, I haven't heard that in a long time. But that feels like something that's like definitely a violation in a more obvious way than economics. But then maybe if you really feel like there are these strong links, and maybe even getting like an Australian person to judge how much they would want to engage in something that's an economic violation in the U.S. if they feel like with their Australian mind, like, oh, things are really bad in the U.S. and if you're poor in the U.S., that's really bad. So that consequence is even worse. And just to see like what is actually doing the lifting for this effect. It just sounds like we need more data.
Yeah, I feel confused about everything now, but I guess that's the point. I'm glad I'm not a social psychologist. It sounds hard.
It's okay. We're in good hands. Ariana's doing it. She's got a lot of work in the pipeline. So, and maybe you can help her collect an Australian sample. So you actually have a new paper out looking at these different kind of approaches to thinking about addressing inequity. So kind of what we were talking about, like thinking about, oh, let's solve the problem at hand right now without talking about the fact that there's an inequity behind it versus thinking about the root cause of the problem. You've actually done work looking at this idea of why people might choose to focus on the cause versus the consequences of these social issues. So could you first talk about the different categories that people might take when they're engaging with social problems? So like doing things one-to-one with another person to try to help them make them feel better versus protesting and different kind of lenses like that.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of great work, both in the collective action space and also in the pro-social behavior space of what can we do when we see a problem. So the pro-social behavior work focuses on things like, might I donate to a cause that I find important? Might I do this sort of like one-on-one help, right? Where might I confront an issue when I see one? While the collective action space focused more on these larger systemic issues and what might we do more as a group to try and address the larger issue, right? So that incorporates both bringing awareness of the issue. So things like going to protests, posting information, like trying to get people on board with what the issue is, and also, you know, lobbying for trying to address the issue. And so I had this essentially like obsession with this distinction between whether we're addressing the root cause of something or we're addressing the consequence. And I thought about it a lot, not necessarily in the context of inequality, but kind of just in the context of a lot of things. So like, I am really passionate about education policy, and I always found it really interesting that people were really supportive of things like charter schools and not as supportive of trying to change the way that we fund education away from property taxes in particular areas. So in the US, there's these charter schools that are essentially partially private schools, partially public schools. So they get public funding, but they have more leeway to do what they want. And so, and it really varies in the US. There's not like one overarching way that people get allocated to different schools and where they end up going to school. But I want to say most of the time, a lot of the public school funding comes from property taxes. So in areas that have bigger, more expensive property, more money is going to go into those schools compared to areas that have lower property values. And so then you see these disparities in education, right? And so one sort of solution were to open these charter schools in areas that are lower income, try and give more education to those groups. And so the lens that I was seeing that is, of course, right now, these students need as much education as possible and aren't getting the resources that they need in the schools that they'd necessarily be allocated to, depending on where they live. And so one band-aid would be to go to this charter school, but it doesn't change the fact that not everyone can go to that charter school. And there's going to be a lot of other students that are going to end up in the less resourced schools, right? So like, I'm devoting my energy to try and mitigate the consequences, you know, allow some students to get some of that better education, but not everyone. So the root cause of the fact that there's this disparity in schools' resources still remains. And so I use that lens for a lot of problems, right? For example, when George Floyd was murdered, a lot of people donated to the family in these GoFundMe campaigns, which is amazing, right? Like those families need those resources. But it doesn't change the fact that police violence is still a huge issue, right? But other people supported some of these movements that were trying to, for example, like defund the police or other types of movements that were trying to reallocate resources and how we police Black American communities, which may not necessarily be successful, right? But it's a way to try to mitigate the cause. But so thinking about that, mitigating the cause is a gamble. You're kind of sure of whether that solution is going to work. You have to think about it as what's going to work in the long term. Versus when thinking about the consequences, for example, thinking about these sorts of charter schools, thinking about donating to these GoFundMe campaigns, it helps that one individual with the resources that they might need or a couple of individuals that might need it, but that problem still remains, right? So thinking about social problems more generally from this lens, and then we borrow from construal level and from regulatory scope, which is essentially an expansion of the construal level framework to look at what might allow me to expand or broaden my scope when I think about an issue, what might narrow my scope when I think about an issue. And so there are these different, what they call tools that allow you to either expand your scope or narrow your scope. And we propose that these sorts of tools might also be used to help explain when people might want to address the cause of a particular issue or address the consequence. And another example that we use throughout the paper is thinking about poverty. So one cause of poverty would be this economic insecurity. So we could try and volunteer for organizations that are seeking to lobby to create more economic security for people in need, trying to somewhat address that cause. Or we could think about trying to engage in solutions that address the consequences of poverty, things like housing insecurity, food insecurity, so donating at food kitchens. And so we proposed that creating a more narrow scope, or when your control is a more lower level or more proximal, that might lead you to want to engage in these actions that are more consequence focused. So things like volunteering at food kitchens versus when you're put into a broader scope, you think more about the larger picture that might lead people to want to engage in these solutions that focus a little bit more on the cause. And the relationship might be bidirectional as well. So if you're engaging in something that's more cause focused, it might broaden how you think about the problem versus if you are engaging in these more consequence-focused solutions, it would narrow how you think about the problem. So it's kind of the paper of my like thoughts friendship luckily gets, you sometimes get to publish those kinds of things, of the sort of like way that I view a lot of issues of just like, if I see a teacher that's like, I can't pay my medical bills, I'm like, what's wrong with the healthcare system? Less so like, oh no, like I should help this individual. Not that I don't want to help this individual, of course. It's just like, what about the next teacher who can't pay their medical bills and the next teacher? But both actions are really, really important, especially because it is so hard to address the causes of these issues. Otherwise, if we could, they wouldn't be issues for so long.
So my question in terms of this framework is, what determines whether my scope is larger or more narrow? Is it like, so is it something that's subject to change really easily? Like something like, maybe you read a paragraph that tells you about how important these proximal consequences versus distal causes are? Or is it something that's more like you might have a disposition to be more cause versus consequence focused? Like you mentioned, when you're seeing something that's like, this teacher can't pay their bills, you think, oh my gosh, why are things like this? We need to fix the system. And maybe that's because you think about these systems so much, whereas someone else might just relate to that person. So what are the determinants of when someone would be in these different states of mind?
I think the cop-out answer is probably both are happening. I think there might be an individual difference where some people are just thinking a little bit more broadly when they think about these issues, and some people that are thinking about it in a little bit more narrow of a focus. But I also think that there's something that, at least if we borrow from the control work, it's something that could be manipulated. So we can manipulate whether people are thinking a little bit more narrowly or thinking broader. And that's something I've yet to test. That's what I hope to test in the future work that builds from this model. So I think there hasn't been as much empirical support. It's really more of a borrowing from the control work that has looked at manipulating your scope and looking at how that impacts way you think about solutions and think about problems. And so I really want to, you know, take that work into the kind of social change space and into the social problem space, these like large social level problems of inequality, climate change, things like that. But yeah, I would say my guess is that we could do both. And so ways to expand or contract scope, I hypothesize a few ways that we can do that in the paper. So for example, some things might be like, if I talk about the groups that are affected by poverty or like the large amounts of people that are affected by poverty, perhaps that sort of larger group level versus if I ask people to think more individually, think about one person that might be experiencing poverty, that differentiation might expand or contract my scope and lead to someone wanting to engage in causes if they're thinking about the groups versus consequences if they're thinking about that particular individual. And so that's definitely something, right, we can empirically test in the lab. And so that's definitely something I'd like to do. Another example that we propose is that if you think about the future, what might happen in the future, think about what might hypothetically occur in the future, that might lead you to want to address things more at the causal level versus if you think about the present, think about the now, that might make you think a little bit more about the present. So for example, if you're thinking about poverty, like, okay, that person that I'm seeing in poverty might need a meal, might need a place to stay, something a little bit more consequence focused versus if you're thinking more broadly of what might that person need in the future or what might a group of people in poverty might need in the future, it might lead you to think, okay, how do we get this person out of the situation so that the situation ends, right? How do we address that root cause?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess in terms of like implications, and I know that a lot of times in psych, we're kind of more descriptive, so you might not necessarily have like a use for this description, but does this imply that maybe for activists or people who are trying to lead different social movements or people who are leading volunteer organizations at soup kitchens and things like that, that they should make sure to kind of match their messaging about the scope with the type of activity that they want people to engage in?
I think that's how I think about it. And that's what I'd hope would be an implication, right? Is like, if you want to get people on board with addressing the cause, start thinking about describing the problem as something broader, like having people think about the future, having people think about groups, having them think about kind of like the systemic factors that are going on versus, yeah, if you want to get people to think about the consequences, give a narrative example of an individual, have them think about what they need at this present moment. And that might help get people more engaged in that particular solution that you want. I think oftentimes with a lot of these issues, we kind of smush those two solutions together. Yeah. And I think that oftentimes that might muddle what our findings actually are, right? If I'm if my anger is directed at a particular situation, I might not necessarily be like, well, this is a larger problem. For example, I think you see that a lot with how people think about police violence. And maybe this is an individual difference where some people just don't think this is a systemic problem. So the only thing to do is to help those who are affected to address those consequences. But there are people, right, who do see this as a large systemic problem and want to address that cause. And so kind of direct their attention to those sorts of actions. And those actions would be different, right? If you don't think that there's a problem, you're not going to want to reshift the budget of how we allocate money towards police, right? You're going to want to just keep things as are if you think there's no problem.
One thing that I was thinking, which you also kind of touched on earlier, was this idea of like, a lot of the times people just don't care. And so I was wondering if you think that actually might fit into your framework in the sense that if things become maybe too distal, then it's like, oh, I just don't care. And then also if they become too proximal, maybe it's like too intense to deal with. So you lose the resources to deal with them because it's just too much. Although, yeah. Of course, obviously sometimes if it's too close, then you just have to deal with it as a survival thing. But yeah, I was just wondering how you think this framework fits with galvanizing action at all. And you touched on this idea of like, maybe people don't even see this issue as a problem and wouldn't do anything about it because of that. But would those people who don't see police violence as an issue, would they want to engage with a victim of police violence and this kind of consequence of it if they don't see it as an issue? I guess how we get people to act in general, and if you think your framework helps us with that too.
When I first initially wrote the paper, it was really like for people who already are on board with something being an issue, and then once you're on board with the larger issue, like poverty is a problem. And then if I'm thinking more narrowly, I'm going to try to address the consequences. I'm thinking broadly, I'm going to try and address the cause. But I do think that for those who just don't see the problem whatsoever, I'd have to think a little bit more. I think it's a great question to think about how regulatory scope and kind of control fits with this amongst people who are just like, this is not an issue. Yeah, it's tough because I'm thinking something is a problem is also on a bit of a spectrum. So like you may not say it's a huge problem, but you might say, oh, this is like somewhat of a problem. And I think if you think that the problem is there, but it's not huge, perhaps then you're not trying to address the cause because there's no need. It's just this sort of like, well, you know, it's not that bad. So no need to like rehaul an entire system, to rehaul the way we fund particular things or to change anything more generally, but I can help the people that might be affected. And so perhaps for people who don't think there's a problem, they might be more directed towards these actions that are a little bit more consequence focused. So like, yeah, maybe they don't think poverty is a huge problem, but they know it affects a few people. So they'll go to the food kitchen and try and help provide some food. But like rehauling the entire system, which potentially need to be done to really address the problem, is not necessary. And so they're not in support of these sorts of larger policy measures.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think something for me that was interesting when I was reading the paper was like, I feel like the tension between dealing with the causes versus the consequences of these social inequities feels like just that, like a tension as an individual of like, where should I be putting my energies? And I've also seen, you know, like, I feel like there's a lot of debates on social media about this stuff too, like specifically in terms of, maybe this is slightly different, but in terms of voting, where I've seen people be like, you shouldn't vote at all. And this idea of voting is just dealing with the consequences of issues that we already have, but we're not dealing with the cause. And like, we should really be like dismantling these entire systems. And I mean, some might say that that's quite extreme, but you know, I've seen a lot of debates about that. And I feel like there is also a tension of people saying, I guess back to what we were talking about before, like moralizing these issues of like, you're a horrible person if you're not dealing with the issues that we really have right now, that like, if you're choosing to not vote and therefore let someone who is going to make things significantly worse for some people right now versus like, it's your duty to try to root out all of these bad things that we're currently dealing with by refusing to engage and trying to start the revolution to actually root out these issues. And I feel like that tension also causes an action because you're like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what I think. And like both of these, as you're saying, are really important. But then how do we choose, I guess?
I completely agree. I think it's a huge tension. And I think that it highlights the complexities of trying to address the causes of problems. So like, I don't think everyone agrees with how to address the cause of a particular issue, right? As you even said, there's some people who are like, I think we should just not be voting and start from the beginning, redo the system from scratch. That highlights the broader part of the problem of how hard it is to address the cause, of how difficult it is to have to restart an entire system. And so that might seem particularly impossible. And so thinking about this cause consequence as almost like a spectrum instead of a dichotomy. And so at the extreme end of addressing a cause would be just revamping everything, starting a new society kind of thing. But then there's smaller ways to try to address a particular cause. You kind of are almost like both narrow and broad in your scope. So kind of having both, but maybe you'd support something that isn't as extreme, but is still trying to address that particular problem at hand. So yeah, I think it gets a little bit convoluted. If you're at the most distal possible, all the problems are probably coming online, right? Like when you think about environmental problems, you could very easily think about how that impacts racial inequality and how that impacts all these other issues that we have. And then just being like, it's all messed up. Let's start from scratch. But unless you're maybe not totally proximal, but you're like a little bit more narrow, but still broader, perhaps you're not thinking about every single issue, but you're focusing on climate change. And you're like, okay, how do I address fossil fuels? I might need to vote for people who are trying to make that a priority, because that is one large cause of climate issues. And so you become a little bit more narrow, but not as broad. But I agree, it's an interesting sort of tension. And I think what we often do, because I think it is easier because you see the benefits, is addressing the consequences, right? If I volunteer for a food kitchen, I'm going to see somebody eat. That problem of somebody not eating is solved. I see the direct benefit of my action versus if I'm trying to support perhaps dismantling a system that might take a really long time. You'd have to get everybody on board. It's just like much more complicated. And so you can see why it's easier when you think about yourself as an individual, which in and of itself is narrowing your scope and being like, what can I do? And you start just thinking about all the small things that you can do, which end up being a little bit more consequence focused. But I think that it's just an interesting practice to kind of think like, okay, what kind of actions do I think are effective? And how are they going to be effective? Are they going to dismantle the root cause? Are they going to allow this problem to continue, but someone's going to be helped and there's going to be necessary aid being provided? I think oftentimes people are really dogmatic in how they think about what's right and wrong, like you said, when it comes to moralizing issues. But I think it's just like an interesting thought practice on like, what do you care about? What are the ways that you might want to try to address it? And what are the barriers towards some of those actions? Like there's going to be cost benefit to a lot of things that we do. And so utilizing that sort of perspective, I think is really interesting. What are these sorts of costs and benefits people have when trying to engage in certain actions, and what keeps them from it? What doesn't? I feel like that just like drives a lot of my research in general. But yeah, it is an interesting thought question.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it also is helpful for people to maybe hear this and think about what resonates with them the most, and reflecting on causes versus consequence and whether that aligns with what you think is important or where you think you might be the most useful might be helpful in just kind of resolving that. And like just putting the labels on it helps. I think like when I see those debates online, I don't think of it as cause versus consequence.
And it is true that both have costs and both have strengths. And I feel like sometimes I fall into this trap where I'm like, well, obviously we should just address the cause because it'll fix all the problems. But then like, if that's going to take, you know, 20 years to be implemented, what's going to happen in that interim, right? To those people who aren't getting the right education that they need, to those people who aren't getting the right resources that they need. Like, right, so both actions I think are really important and provide something to the situation. It's just, yeah, just like playing with that tension, I think it's just interesting and important, I think.
So another thing when I was listening to this, I was thinking, if I am more a cause or a consequence kind of change maker, I wouldn't call myself a change maker. Fixer, protester. I'm not sure what the word is, but what kind of action I can do. And when I was listening to this idea about all the changes with systems at large, I felt super overwhelmed and quite panicky. So I realized I'm definitely a consequence person. Like that's what feel like I'm naturally more capable of.
But how do you know, you've also done some campaigning.
Yeah, I guess when I do that, I guess I was like thinking of dismantling the system at large. And I was like, I don't know if I'm equipped for that.
I see what you're saying. I think that's also the tough thing is like, what does addressing the cause mean? Because I think people will think that means different things. But I know that you've done some work organizing for Indigenous people in Australia. Yeah. And that feels like addressing causes in a way. You're trying to change systems, if it's like changing things in government so that you're preventing future things from being as bad as they have been or as they are, versus like maybe working directly with individuals who are affected by the histories of violence in Australia. So I feel like you've done both, but maybe I could see, especially when Ariana was describing, if you're working in a soup kitchen, you see someone get fed and that warms your heart directly. I could see, especially for the campaigning, that a big part of what you would get out of it and the fulfilling part is being around other people and seeing
exactly
the change you're doing together.
So. Yeah, or like having a conversation with someone and getting them to understand. You know, I have gone out to hand out flyers at polling booths and things like that. And obviously the idea for voting is to have some sort of change. But what I get out of it is like talking with people and connecting with people, especially people who may not know about the issues or have been given different information, and like connecting with them and getting them to understand where the views that we have are coming from, and getting them to come together on that. So that's what I love about that. So that still feels like connection and I guess consequence. Yeah. So I guess that when I do those things, that's what I like about it. Even when I go to a protest, I kind of love the feeling of everyone being together and like we can all see hope for a better future and we all have this together. I find that really, yeah, that's that I get a lot out of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's something that I don't think Ariana's work touches on directly, but the idea of what are you trying to get out of engaging with either a cause or consequence? Like if it's really important to you to connect with people, then in a way, like you could do that with either, right? You could do that with connecting with people who've been directly affected by whatever the situation is that you're trying to address, but also by talking to people and trying to get them to maybe change how they're voting or support a specific policy or get them to campaign with you. So that's kind of interesting and maybe something that is like goes across all of those types of cause, consequence, whatever part of the spectrum the action is on. So I think that's cool. But I don't know what I am.
I would feel that you're a cause because you always do this really, from my point of view, like complex, complicated organizing, like with the strike and everything. You were so involved. And Ava's looking at me like, what are you talking about, Beth?
I just always feel like I don't do anything.
I see the opposite. You did so much for the strike.
I was there. I didn't do that much. Anyway.
And you're also involved in a lot of groups and things.
I don't see myself that way. But I think that's why I was asking Ariana about like inaction, is because I feel like I'm always not actually doing anything. Like I'll go to some protests and I engage a little bit. But it's just like the day-to-day of organizing is so hard and so draining. And I do feel the same way, like going to a protest, some protests, not all of them, but going to some protests and feeling like, wow, like we're all here, we're all together, maybe something can actually change. But then, you know, once you've been to a few and you're like, here we are again, like it's, I feel like that emotion is so draining. But I think the toughest part for me is just figuring out what to do. And so I feel like cause, consequence, this is going to sound terrible, but I feel like addressing the consequences for me, I think it's hard for me to not feel like, what's the point? Even though like you can really see if there's someone suffering, they need help. But if we all directed our energies into changing the system or changing whatever policy is happening to cause those things, then it would be more effective. I don't know. I think this is why you felt like this episode was depressing, because I also was like, I don't know what to do.
So I think you're being way too hard on yourself, because I think I really do. You do heaps since I've known you. Wherever you've been involved and cared a lot about a lot of stuff. So I think that that's an incorrect assessment on yourself. But in terms of motivation for things, I'm going to tell a really nice story, because I think sometimes it can get hard to think, We do all this, nothing changes. We do all this, nothing changes. So why do we keep doing this? And I think it's important to remember the things. It does change and it does work. Or we wouldn't keep doing it. Like if protesting and doing these things never worked, you think at one point in time we would have worked out something else to do. So I have a really nice story. When I was in undergrad at NYU, my friends were really involved in NYU Divest, which was to get NYU to divest from fossil fuels. NYU has heaps of money. I can't remember their endowment, but it's just insane. So that amount of money does have an impact on the world. And we're investing in fossil fuels, and my friends did so much. I mean, once they slept in the president, is it a president or CEO of NYU? I can't remember. But they slept in his elevator so he couldn't get up to the top of the library. Like all these sorts of things. They were protesting all the time, constantly. They put so much effort into it and nothing happened. So it could be like, okay, well, why are we doing this? And there was an article in The Guardian, I think last year, that NYU has divested from fossil fuels. And the president made an acknowledgement that it's because of this action. I think NYU Divest paused for a bit and then the campaign started again and they divested and they acknowledged that it's because of this student action for all of those years. So this, you know, I was there 10 years ago and they're like, this all led to NYU divesting. So maybe even when we're doing something at the time and we don't see the change, it cannot feel motivating. But I do believe that continuing to do that, it will lead to change at some point, and it does make a difference. And this was such a beautiful example of that. And we didn't see the change when we were there, but it's happened. And that's, we're not doing these things for us either. We're doing it for everyone. So
yeah, that's nice. No, I mean, you're right. You're totally right. And I think the research on social movements basically shows that none of these patterns are linear. And I think we expect things to be linear. So we expect like, if I put in this amount of work, then I'll get this out. But really, it's about these tipping points and this buildup of pressure that could be happening from years. And I think your friends is a great example because they put in so much time and then they graduated without seeing anything change. But then their continued push caused something to break later on. So I think that's definitely true and something to remember and maybe something that will get people motivated. I do think it's helpful to think about what types of things you want to address, cause versus consequence, where you want to put your energy. And I hope that this episode, like depressing as it might be at some points, I hope it just does encourage people to think a little bit about like, it's not like everyone needs to engage in collective action all the time or even at all if you don't want to. But if there's some issue that you feel like, oh, this is important to address, this is something that I care about, I think this categorization of cause versus consequence, and then also thinking about even if I'm not seeing the result that I would like to see now, it doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. I think that's helpful. And also, Beth, ever our optimist, giving us good advice, I think finding things that you can get out of organizing and being involved in different actions, like connecting with people and like having these conversations where you're really changing people's minds, or maybe you're also learning something and that's something that's important to you. I think finding ways that you can enjoy the process of those actions is also really helpful. And I hope this helps people like reflect and think about if there's something that they did want to do that they haven't done. And I'll be thinking about it. I'll be mulling it over. I'll be mulling it good. All right, so finally, if you could just tell us a little bit about some of the future direction that your work is going into, that you're excited about, and that you want to share.
I'm really starting to empirically test the stuff on cause and consequence action. I'm really, really interested in, is what I say true? Or I guess not true, but yeah, you know, will we support a hypothesis or not? So really looking at some of that. I'm also really interested in looking at how do we frame certain actions to get people to want to engage in them? So when thinking about, for example, climate change, oftentimes we talk about stop driving and stop littering and stop doing all these things versus start biking and start engaging and, you know, some environmentally sustainable behavior. And like we find in some of that work that people are more of attuned to starting something. So talking about action as an engagement versus a disengagement. And so thinking about that for larger social movements and that sort of that tension. And yeah, and then following up on also the first project that I was talking about, seeing how discussing different disparities in different inequality domains manifests. What are some of the other mechanisms? Can we turn off our effect? And that sort of thing. And if anybody ever has any questions, let me know. And or if you ever want to talk about work-life balance, I'm a very big pro. I love good balance to the work and
life. Do you
want to
share some of your work-life balance tips and thoughts?
I am very much a no work on weekends person. And I know that that is not very common in academia, but I really love a good reset button. And so not working on the weekends is definitely one thing that I've really tried to implement, even since I started my PhD, which I recognize not the norm. And I was very much that person in the cohort being like, well, let's all not. And if we all don't do it, then then it won't be the norm. But, you know, not everybody, you know, in general, that freedom of when you can work in academia is wonderful. But I really stick to this 9-to-5 sort of thing, because at the end of the day, my brain is tired and I don't make good sentences don't, I'm doing it right now, but like sentences don't form in a good way that sounds good. And so I'm going to have to redo any sort of writing that I do if I do it in a tired state. And so having these sorts of resets, I think, is just really important. And in that way, it's just important for your productivity, which isn't, of course, the only goal in life to be productive. There's other goals in life too. But I think taking time for yourself is really important. Taking time for your family, your friends, and your community, finding what makes you happy and sparks joy. Yeah, really, really hope that everybody can feel that and not feel constant pressure to just do more, more, more. And just feels like, okay, like I'm getting things done, things are going, and life is good more generally.
Yeah, something that Ariana said right before we started recording also, which I think was helpful as a reminder, even though obviously Ariana does work on very serious issues, as you heard. But is that we're not solving cancer. We're not doing anything that like needs to happen right now. Even if you're doing serious work, like the papers that you put out can wait probably a day or 3 hours or a weekend or even a month. And I think that's also just a good reminder that what are you, if you're rushing and you're killing yourself, like what are you doing it for? Especially if you're in a field like ours. So I think that was just a good reminder to me and hopefully to you.
And I think it's tough to swallow, I think, but if we all adopt it, then it'll work. Right? This is a collective action problem.
Yeah, collective action. Ending with a call to action.
Yeah.
I like it.
Everyone go to sleep. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ariana. We loved having you on today.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great to meet you.
Thank you to Dr. Ariana Brown for joining us this episode.
Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Montesouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com. Thank you.